Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Unexpected Elements is all about finding the surprising science angles to everyday news.
Mind absolutely blown.
Amazing to me.
That's Unexpected Elements from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nigel Adderley, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday the 30th of August, these are our main stories. The President of Gabon is reported to be under house arrest after army officers seized power. Thousands have fled the Gulf Coast of Florida as Hurricane Idalia makes landfall. Also in this podcast...
Looks like a drone grenade. Looks like a grenade from a drone that just landed.
Just hit right in front of our vehicle. We're trying to take some cover now.
As cruise missiles hit Kyiv and Ukrainian drone strikes cause damage across Russia, we hear about life on the Eastern Front line. We start this podcast with news of another coup in West Africa, where Gabon's President Ali Bongo was declared the winner of Saturday's election at 4 a.m. local time this morning. But within an hour, the military moved in. An unidentified spokesman read out a statement surrounded by other men in uniform.
Au nom du peuple gabonais.
In the name of the people of Gabon, and as guarantors of the institutions, we have decided to defend peace by putting an end to the current regime. To this end, the general elections of the 26th of August 2023 and the truncated results are cancelled. The borders are closed until further notice. All the institutions of the Republic are dissolved.
The president of Gabon, Ali Bongo, is reported to be under house arrest. And on the streets of the capital, Libreville, there were scenes of jubilation. So, celebrations there, but how has the news gone down elsewhere? A question for our correspondent in the region, Will Ross.
It's often difficult to gauge sort of the overall popularity from, you know, what happens quickly on the streets. But certainly, people I've spoken to and from the videos that are circulating, there is genuine joy at the news that the president has been ousted. Other coups we've seen in West Africa, Central Africa, have seen, you know, what to some eyes look a bit like sort of orchestrated shows of support where renter crowds are kind of brought out or at least persuaded to come out and show their support. Whereas in this case, you're seeing men and women and quite a lot of support. There's also been an interesting development in that a video which appears to show the detained President Ali Bongo making an appeal in a short video for there to be lots of noise made about his predicament and saying that he's been arrested and his wife's being held in a different place. We haven't independently verified that video, but it certainly seems to be a video of the deposed president making that appeal for there to be, you know, a lot of noise made around the world and presumably to try and get support from international bodies.
And this the latest in a series of coups in the region. What is the impact?
Yes, you're right. I mean, the eighth in Western Central Africa since 2020. I think it's going to be slightly different, I think, from other ones. I mean, we had the coup in Niger just last month, and that one, you know, was in a country where there was some support for the president and some support for the opposition. You know, you could say it was fairly split, so you would get some people celebrating a seizure of power there. But in this case, I think there is, you know, a great deal of anger at the way that the election was conducted. It produced a winner, Ali Bongo, with roughly two-thirds of the votes. But, you know, it definitely wasn't a level playing field. The opposition says it was a complete sham, and the fact that the internet had been shut off, observers and journalists barred from reporting on it, you know, pretty suspicious signs. So a bit of a dilemma for the international community now. I know that the Commonwealth, of which Gabon is now a member, and France and China and the EU have sort of expressed their concern. France has condemned the coup and called for President Bongo to be reinstated, but I think they'll find these messages of anger at the coup and calling for any kind of reinstatement will go down very badly in Gabon itself.
Will Ross. Evacuation orders are in force in more than 20 counties in the US state of Florida, where Hurricane Idalia is causing chaos. It's now developed into an extremely powerful storm, fueled by the unusually warm waters in the Gulf of Mexico. A storm surge of up to 5 meters high along the Gulf Coast is predicted. In a news conference repeatedly interrupted by power failures, the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, urged people to take it seriously and avoid taking risks.
It is a major hurricane, as we've been saying it was likely to be for the last couple days, and we just hope everybody stays safe. Don't put your life at risk by doing anything dumb at this point. This thing's powerful. If you're inside, just hunker down until it gets past you. You don't want to be messing around with these winds. There's going to be things flying all over the place. Obviously, if you're in a place that's close to the coast and you see that surge, that's going to be legitimate surge. It's going to be a big deal, and it's going to be very, very dangerous.
Reed Timmer is what's termed a storm chaser. He works for the commercial forecaster AccuWeather. He's in Cedar Key, an island city off the northwest coast of Florida in the Gulf of Mexico, and he told me what conditions were like.
Yeah, we have a life-threatening storm surge here in Cedar Key, Florida right now. There's about 6 to 8 feet of water, waves on top of that. And I see a lot of debris, a lot of destroyed structures inundated by floodwater. And I actually see a floating septic tank going by right now, just floating down the main street here of Cedar Key. So it's just a heartbreaking scene here along the coastline.
And presumably everybody else now has cleared the area.
Yes, yeah, everybody's out of the area. There's just a couple of people here. There were some emergency people that have retreated to higher ground. So everybody is just hunkering down on high ground right now, waiting for these floodwaters to recede. But a major storm surge here, winds probably 80, 90 miles per hour in gusts.
And when do you think this could reach its peak?
I think it's peaking right about now, I would say, here in Cedar Key in terms of the storm surge. And as it's coming ashore, we're going to continue with these westerlies up through high tide. But the flooding's likely to continue for a couple more hours, and hopefully it'll recede shortly after that.
And how bad is this compared to other storms you've seen in the area?
It's pretty bad, but in this area, it's about as bad as it's ever gotten since, like, the mid-1800s in terms of having a storm this powerful up here. In terms of like a Hurricane Ian, for example, last year, just terribly devastating. That was a high-end Category 4. So every storm is different in terms of their impact. This one is unique in terms of the record-breaking storm surge and the flooding and the structures that are getting inundated by the floodwaters.
Reed Timmer, a storm chaser in Florida. The drone attacks by Ukraine are reaching deep into Russian territory. Russia's military said it had shot down Ukrainian drones over several regions, including Moscow, Bryansk, Kaluga, Oryol, and Ryazan. In the northwest city of Pskov, near the Estonian border, two cargo planes were hit in an attack on the airport. The regional governor, Mikhail Veronikov, gave this update to reporters.
A drone attack was repelled at the airport. No casualties, thank God. The scope of the damage is now being checked. All services are on site. We held an emergency staff meeting and outlined the first actions.
Meanwhile, Russia has attacked the Ukrainian capital with cruise missiles. The mayor of Kyiv says two people have been killed and another wounded in the latest Russian air attack. So, aerial attacks on both sides. But how significant are they? I asked our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg what damage the Ukrainian drone attacks had done.
In a sense, this follows a pattern, right? In recent weeks, we've seen an increase in the number of drone attacks across Russia. and sometimes deep inside Russian territory. What we've been seeing over the last few hours is a particularly large-scale drone attack targeting six regions of Russia and also Russian-occupied Crimea. It's not clear how much damage has been done by the attacks. I mean, the Russians say that most of the drones have been shot down by Russian air defense systems. But the most significant attack appears to have been in Pskov. That's in northwestern Russia. An airfield, an airport there, has been attacked. Initially, Russian officials said that four military transport planes had been damaged. That was later revised down to two. Another of the regions that's been targeted is Bryansk region. That borders Ukraine. And according to reports this morning, drone attacks have continued there. In the morning, the local TV tower was targeted, although apparently not damaged, in a drone attack.
And Russia said when this conflict started that its main issue was to protect the security of its people. Do the Russian people feel safer with all these drone attacks?
Yeah, it's a key question. You're absolutely right. There is an irony here, because when President Putin launched the so-called special military operation a year and a half ago, the Kremlin did say that there was a need to boost Russia's national security. The Kremlin claimed that Russia was threatened by Ukraine, by America, by NATO, by the West in general. But in fact, what's happened is that Russia's now more insecure, the Russian people are more insecure than they were a year and a half ago. Does that mean that the population here has joined the dots and concluded that this insecurity is a result of the invasion? I don't think that's happened yet, no. Partly because of the propaganda in the state media here, which from morning till night tells Russians that what is happening today is a result of external threats, that Russia is a besieged fortress being threatened by external forces. So in a sense, these continuing drone attacks play into the Kremlin's narrative that it has created, that Russia is the victim and is threatened by enemies abroad.
Steve Rosenberg. The air raids came as Ukraine's much-reported counter-offensive moves slowly in the south, although the fighting is intensifying in the east, where Russia has renewed its attacks with an estimated tens of thousands of men. For now, Ukraine's advances are modest, but they are costing lives. The BBC's Quentin Somerville spent the past month with Ukrainian brigades fighting in the area.
This whole area is covered in craters. Trees that have been turned into matchsticks. This is a hellish landscape. Everything's burning. Flames at the side of the road.
The full windscreen, I can't see anything. There's a vehicle in front of us. It's kicking up mighty clouds of dust. Of course, the Russian drones will be able to see that too.
Looks like a grenade from a drone that just landed. Just hit right in front of a vehicle. We're trying to take some cover now. You okay? Okay?
The gunner has fallen inside from his turret. He signals that he's unhurt. But the fireball about a metre in front of the vehicle wasn't from a grenade. It was a kamikaze drone, as the battalion commander with a call sign speaker explains from the passenger seat.
Drone. That was the drone attack. They saw us from the top and then tried to attack. So they sent a 50 feet drone and now they are seeking us and hunting us. So we need to go faster and go back.
Get out or stay here.
Get out. Thanks, man. So we've had to stop going forward. The danger here is, the deeper you get into the forest, cover doesn't get better. There's constant Russian artillery setting some of the trees on fire. There are drones up above.
Battles across the Eastern Front have reignited. Ukraine says it's now the hottest front, with some 100,000 Russian troops deployed in new battle groups.
This is the problem facing Ukraine at the moment. It's moving forward in the south of the country bit by bit. It's counter-offensive. But here in the east, it's Russia that's on the attack. They've been losing ground here. And all of this means that those limited Ukrainian resources are being stretched, manpower and equipment, to breaking point.
The Russian gains for now are modest, but around Kupiansk, a city recaptured in September from the Russians last year, it's about 25 miles from the border, civilians are again within range of Russian guns. Evacuation orders have been issued. 72-year-old Antonina Semenivna lived under Russian occupation for 6 months and says she won't again.
What do you think? Will there be anything good? I don't know anything. How it keeps booming and booming and booming and booming. If only they could chase them away from here, so that they would be further away at least.
Russia's military gains don't add up to much yet, but for Antonina and others, they mean everything.
Quentin Somerville in Ukraine. Still to come on this podcast.
They look and feel just like your everyday clothing. But in this case, we're using pressurized air to apply forces to the body from within the fabric. We're basically allowing this extra communicative channel.
How your T-shirt could one day be giving you directions like a sat-nav.
The road to success seems quick.
My first try to go to the Olympic Games was in 1980.
Everybody's been seeing me run for years growing up.
Get to know the people behind the medals as Olympians and Paralympians share their stories.
My story can help so many other victims and survivors.
On the Podium from the BBC World Service.
The journey and the ups and downs.
Listen now by searching for On the Podium wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Australia is to hold a constitutional referendum on the 14th of October on whether to recognise its Indigenous people for the first time. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has urged Australians to vote yes.
Constitutional recognition through a voice, a way for all of us to recognise Indigenous Australians and their history in our Constitution. And a form of recognition that will importantly make a positive difference to their lives and their futures.
Success would also enshrine the right of Aboriginal and Torres Strait people to be consulted on laws that impact on their communities. But the yes vote is trailing in the polls, and there are fears that failure to approve the referendum could harm race relations in Australia. Our correspondent Phil Mercer is in Sydney.
The No campaign is a broad church of various groups, and they have many complaints about the government's proposal to recognise Australia's Indigenous peoples in the Constitution by setting up a so-called voice to Parliament, an independent panel that would advise governments and MPs on laws and policies. Now, those critics say that the whole proposal for the Indigenous voice really presumes that Australia's original inhabitants will always be disadvantaged and will always need a permanent voice at the heart of Australia's federal parliament. Other critics say that this is a white elitist project, that it's paternalistic, essentially telling Indigenous people what's good for them. So other critics say that the detail around the power and the role of this panel is a bit vague. And as a result, the opinion polls are suggesting that the government here does have an uphill battle to convince voters to say yes on October the 14th. Anthony Albanese believes that the voice to Parliament would be a practical and positive way to improve the lives of Indigenous people. They make up 3% of Australia's population, but they suffer very high rates of poverty, unemployment and imprisonment.
Phil Mercer in Sydney. On the Global News Podcast, we aim to look into stories suggested by you. And one listener has emailed to ask for an update on a hunger strike by hundreds of prisoners in Bahrain. They've been on strike since early August to protest about their conditions. Many were detained in 2011 during mass anti-government protests by the majority Shia community. So I asked our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, to tell us more about them.
They see themselves as political prisoners, as prisoners of conscience. There's estimated to be over 1,000 held in Bahrain. This is in Jal prison, which also holds a lot of prisoners who are there for crime. And the political prisoners say that they are treated far worse than the ordinary prisoners, that they don't have as long outside. In fact, they have a radically shorter time that they're allowed to exercise outside, that visitation rights from their families are restricted, their medical care isn't administered properly, they don't have access to education, and they don't have permission to pray together at a mosque in the prison. So all of these things have built up, culminating in this decision earlier this month to stage what is, according to activists in Bahrain, the biggest ever hunger strike. I mean, I've just been hearing from one of them just now who's saying that well over 800 prisoners are participating in this hunger strike now. I mean, some of them have joined since it began more than 3 weeks ago. The authorities put the figure much lower. They have it, I think, around 120. So there's big discrepancies here. But essentially, these are people who see themselves as being imprisoned for political reasons, for basically opposing the Bahraini authorities, and that their conditions are just not acceptable in prison.
And the Bahraini authorities have made some moves to answer their demands, but do the prisoners believe it's too little too late?
They have. I mean, there have been meetings, there have been talks between the Interior Ministry and representatives of the prisoners. There was a statement from the Interior Ministry saying that they would allow more outdoor time. They would look at the duration of visits and at the list of visitors that are allowed, also phone calls. All of these things. What I've been hearing and what I've been told by activists here in the UK who are in contact pretty much all the time with prisoners there is that they've rejected this and they don't feel that it goes anywhere far enough, that it's far too little, too late.
Our Arab Affairs editor Sebastian Usher there, answering one listener's request for an update on hunger strikes in Bahrain. And if you've got a story you'd like us to look into, do get in touch. You can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. In recent years, social media has become an increasingly powerful tool in the hands of politicians, prompting calls for tougher scrutiny. Now, with the 2024 US election campaign gathering pace, X, formerly known as Twitter, has announced it's lifting a ban on political advertising after nearly 4 years. Anna Aslam reports.
X has gone through a number of changes since it was taken over by the billionaire businessman Elon Musk last year. His predecessor, Jack Dorsey, banned political ads in 2019, saying that political message reach should be earned, not bought. In January, though, the platform relaxed the restrictions and began allowing cause-based ads in the U.S. that raise awareness of issues such as voter registration. Now, it's lifting the ban completely. The company said it was committed to free expression and didn't want to censor political debate, but stressed that it would robustly screen and review the ads to prohibit content that spreads false information or seeks to undermine confidence in the election process. X also said it's expanding its safety and election teams, which were heavily cut after Mr. Musk took over. The move could have significant implications for the 2024 election and will help boost X's revenue. Political advertising online has recently become a contentious issue in the U.S., especially after allegations surfaced that Russia used social media to spread disinformation ahead of the 2016 election. Political ads are now allowed on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and YouTube, but are still banned on TikTok.
Anna Aslam. Now, imagine you're trying to find a place you've never been to before using one of the many GPS-based apps available to guide you to your destination. Holding your phone out in front of you can be a bit clunky and potentially attract unwanted attention. But scientists at Rice University in Houston, Texas, have created a device which can feed the same information through your clothing. Dan Preston, an assistant professor of mechanical engineering, is an author of the study.
They look and feel just like your everyday clothing, But in this case, we've incorporated haptic cues, things that take advantage of your sense of touch to convey information. We're using pressurized air to apply forces to the body from within the fabric materials from which we're composing these wearables and garments. And so it feels like a gentle push on the body as we apply air pressure to the wearable. We've incorporated it in wristbands and sleeves and shirts. The actual region that applies force is a little bit bigger than a centimeter by a centimeter. But when we incorporate many of them, they can cover the entire shirt or sleeve that we're using in this work. Our goal here was to actually try to address limitations in terms of, for example, about a billion people that have some partial or full loss of vision, maybe another 1.5 billion people with a partial or full loss of hearing, to instead take advantage of their sense of touch by using this garment to apply forces or feelings of touch on the body. We're basically allowing this extra communicative channel. We started in the lab where we ran tests with human participants to determine whether or not we could convey information effectively. And we found that the users were successful about 90% of the time interpreting this information conveyed through touch. And then from there, what we did was take it outside the lab. We used it to navigate throughout, in this case, the streets of Houston. We were giving haptic cues to tell people when to turn, when to go forward, when to stop. And we found that we had 100% success rate there in terms of getting people to navigate with their hands free with this device. And if you imagine, for example, again, someone that may have limited hearing, maybe someone that wants to keep their eyes on the road, maybe the best way to tell them when to turn or when to proceed forward is to use some sort of a tactile or haptic cue. And so in this case, maybe your shirt, instead of hearing some voice or looking at a screen and taking your eyes off the road, maybe your shirt or sleeve indicates to you when to turn.
Dan Preston from Rice University in Texas. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Alicia Thursting and the producer was Rebecca Wood. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nigel Adderley. Until next time, goodbye.